Cars Macabre, episode 15, What They Consumed, by Helmut Finch. Welcome to Cars Macabre, I'm Barry, your host. How are my pseudopod listeners coping? For anyone who is missing their weekly horror fiction podcast terribly while it's on hiatus as I am, we have a special treat for you this week. For this week, dear listeners, you are going to get your fix of Alistair. Oh, yes, you are, for one. Mr. Alistair Stewart, host of Pseudopod, is here to read you this week's story, What They Consumed, by Helmut Finch. Helmut Finch is an American horror writer who published short fiction in pulp magazines in the first few decades of the 20th century. He is most known for the Biter series of thematically linked psychological horror tales. In 1996, he was posthumously awarded the Son of Wisconsin Medallion by the Lions Club of Chippewa Falls. This manuscript was brought to our attention here at Cast Macabre by C. Deskin Rink, author of The Joining, Our Stab of Fear, Episode 3. He says, I found this manuscript during the renovation of an abandoned farmhouse near Chippewa Falls. It had been secreted away inside the walls along with several handwritten notes, the contents of which I have decided are best kept from the public at large. I have had the authenticity of this manuscript verified independently both by Dr. Rudolf Gentz of Benediction University and Mr. Torek Bestlomnik, editor of the Helmut Finch United Press Association. Aside from the historic importance of being recognized as the discoverer of a heretofore unknown Helmut Finch story, I want nothing to do with that Wisconsin hack. If anyone wants to know more about that dreadful little man, they should be directed to the short story Hometown Horrible by Mr. Matthew Bay. That's all I have to say about Finch. Pseudopod listeners may remember Matthew Bay's story Hometown Horrible from episode 152. Now, we've a tale to tell you.
What They Consumed, by Helmut Finch. Original manuscripts discovered by C. Deskin Rink. 6 doctors performed the autopsy of my son. I was counted amongst their number. Each one of us, a hardened medical man, used to the sights of the human body's ropey and glistening innards. I myself served in the medical corps during the Great War and have seen men's bodies transformed into all manner of grotesque, stringy caricatures by the explosion of shell or the rake of machine gun fire, and yet what I saw inside my son's skull, betwixt the osseous plates where healthy brain pulp usually resides, proved sufficient to send me fleeing the morgue in terror. Yet even that vision, as unholy as it was, did not prove to be the crowning horror of my life. That dark honour goes to the 12 words which proved to be my son's undoing. Each evening at prayer, I thank God that I heard only 8 of those 12 words, lest the unspeakable fate that befell my son also befall me. But each evening, I also increasingly fear that my prayers are being transmitted to a non-existent being. Surely no sane God could oversee a universe which permits such madness. My name is Cornelius McGregor, and I am a wealthy and influential man, owner of the Chicago Standard, several other highly profitable newspapers, as well as the lucrative brewery in Belvoir, Wisconsin, which produces the regional ale, Berghoff. For this reason, and for this reason only, was I able to furnish sufficient funds to bribe all the doctors present at the autopsy into silence. Since that day, only one of them has ever attempted to go public with what he beheld, but certain of my less savory agents ensured that his silence was maintained through the use of a bullet. The entire affair started mundanely enough. Kaylee Jackson, after the death of her husband, the railroad magnate Edmund Jackson Esquire, found herself heading towards a regimented life of piety, within the Sacred Heart Convent, a particularly chaste nunnery. This was a prospect she bore with no stoicism whatsoever, accustomed as she was to the luxuries of her upper-class lifestyle and the material delights entailed thereof. Unbeknownst to her, Edmund Jackson had squandered his considerable fortune upon fast women, slow horses, and the pipe dream which comes from chasing the dragon. The entirety of his last 6 months on Earth would be naught but a charade maintained only by rapidly mounting debt. Suffice to say, when he died of an overdose in the squalid corner of an opium den, he had not so much as a penny to his name. Only marriage to money would resolve Kaylee's problems, but, to be truthful, all the fates conspired against her. Her late husband's massive debt, and her own lack of physical appeal, made remarriage an unlikely prospect, but compounding the issue was the fact that most prominent families regarded her lineage cursed, and preferred to see it extinguished. During that time, I never put stock in the furtive whispers connecting her bloodline with a cabal of warlocks, or the rumours that more than one of her ancestors was ushered into the afterlife with the aid of a hangman's noose during the Salem witch trials. However, my son, Luthien, was an equally unlikely candidate for a fiscally beneficial marriage. He was a sandy-haired brat, little more than a boy, who I had to scold on more than one occasion when he mortified me by fidgeting or picking his nose in the company of his betters. What's more, he fancied himself something of a Lothario, but most of my peers considered him dangerous. More than one rumour abounded regarding his less than wholesome dalliances with various maids or serving girls, and perhaps in another age, a man forcing himself upon the help would have been overlooked. But it was 1922, and such sordid behaviour was something modern sensibilities simply would not tolerate. Kaylee Jackson, yet, came from a prominent family, and despite the darkness surrounding her, a union between her house and mine would allow me to absorb the Jackson name and its ties to the railroad industry, a business I was very anxious to enter into. When I broached the subject to Kaylee, she agreed. Instantly. Her exuberance was somewhat tempered when she actually met Luthien. In the weeks leading up to the wedding ceremony, Luthien's repertoire of complaints regarding his bride was quite unlimited. Kaylee did her best to hide her reddened face when Luthien made unflattering remarks, considering the difference between their ages, for she was nigh a decade and a half his senior, and the detrimental effect placed on her weight line by habitual gastronomical indulgence. There are certain aspects of my younger years that I regret, and this was one of those. So determined was I to gain the prestige of the Jackson name, that I made it my business to be clear, in no uncertain terms, that Luthien would be inducted into adulthood by Kaylee's pudgy hands, regardless of his wishes. The ceremony itself was held at the Cathedral of St. Mark, just on the edge of Cable Street. It is now a slum, filled with addicts and beggars, but during those days it was a splendid edifice, wreathed with white rose bushes and perfumed with holy incense. I spared no expense, hoping that a lavish reception would dispel some of the shadows from Kaylee's unpopular lineage, and I was rewarded when the wedding proved the event of the season, and dominated the society pages for nearly a month. Immediately after, I sent the newlyweds first class to Paris on the luxury steamer Olympic, and, ostensibly, I left them alone. In truth, I shamefully paid several European agents of mine to check up on them at regular intervals. I was burdened with enormous displeasure to find that the marriage bed could hardly be described as warm, and that Luthien spent the majority of his spare time in the most unwholesome of the City of Light's pleasure dens. Even less happy was I when, after less than a week, my son petitioned to me that he be allowed to return to Chicago. An abridging of the post-nuptial holiday to such a degree would look shameful to the rest of high society, so I duly forbade Luthien's return. Eventually, Luthien's repeated requests became so tiresome that I finally acquiesced with the condition that Lady Kaylee accompany him, something which neither of them seemed to desire at that point. On his first night home, overflowing with fatherly concern, I took Luthien aside and spoke to him, awkwardly, about the need to propagate the MacGregor bloodline. This had quite the opposite effect in Luthien, who grew distant and sullen and took to brooding alone in his private quarters for hours on end. Looking back, I dare say I wish I had not been so selfish. Perhaps showing the boy kindness might have steered us away from the eventual. I tried speaking to Kaylee, but she only hissed distasteful comments about how unfair it was to be entrapped in a marriage to a sulky child. She too took to brooding and never emerged, except to demand that the servants bring her a platter laden with the chocolate candies of which she was so fond. This situation continued apace until one morning, when a nervous and excited chambermaid informed me that Luthien and Kaylee were finally well and truly married. From that day on, Luthien held himself much higher when he walked, spoke with no force, no longer hid from me. I was overjoyed, but had I known what was to come, I might have smothered him whilst he slept. Instead, I bought him a new motor car. Kaylee, on the other hand, grew even more reclusive than before. Indeed, I hardly encountered her at all, except for once or twice, when I caught her gorging herself on chocolates whilst thumbing through my collection of rare books. In the following months, Luthien developed a fondness for the drink, and when in his cups, he became aggressive. Cruel. Once or twice, actually striking Kaylee with me present. Soon after, he began beating her on a regular basis. Within a month or two, there came a time where she was never seen without carefully applied makeup covering blotchy patches of black and blue. I tried to confront my son, but during a particularly heated argument, the strain overcame my heart and I collapsed. God, it pains me to admit this, but I think that had a maid not witnessed my distress and summoned a doctor, Luthien would have let me die, right there in the middle of my own drawing room. During my convalescence, he took to hitting me as well. In my weakened state, I could not defend myself and found myself a veritable prisoner in my own home. He tormented me, holding my cane out of reach or spilling my pills on the floor when I felt chest pains. This is something I actually encouraged, for when he tired of abusing dear old Dad, he would take his rage out upon Kaylee with such fury that she was rendered unconscious. On New Year's 1924, Luthien got drunk and crashed his motor car. He returned home in a black mood, tearing apart the furniture, shouting to the rafters about the injustice of it all. After pushing me down, he tore upstairs to his wife's chambers. I could hear her screams for a very, very long time. Kaylee's convalescence took 4 months. Despite the best care, her jaw always clicked whenever she chewed, and the sight in her left eye never fully returned. During Kaylee's recovery, with the doctor's help, I kept Luthien from entering her chambers. This suited him just fine, preferring instead to stay out every night until sunrise. Rumours spread of his attendance at certain depraved orgies held by an underground clique of young gentry, and more than once I had to pay off a poor, weeping girl for reasons best left undescribed. I spent much of my time doting on Kaylee as she recovered. I made sure she was well supplied with chocolates and brought her books from the library. She grew fascinated with the most ghoulish practices of antiquity, the tearing out of the heart by the Aztecs, the fiendish impalements of Vlad Dracul, the red harvests of the priests of Khatrazar, the divinations in human blood by the barbaric Celts, the manifold tortures of the Inquisition. After reading The Wonders of the Invisible World by Cotton Mather, she requested I bring her even more loathsome times. Regarding her morbid obsession as harmless catharsis, I acquiesced. One of my friends, the renowned explorer Dr. Werner von Eichmann, had lent me a copy of a book he'd found amidst the ruins of a tumbled-down temple in the deepest reaches of Africa. I regarded this book, the so-called Torzur Balsior, as an elaborate hoax perpetrated by the locals upon my friend, so I saw no harm in loaning it to Kaylee. I'd read it before, of course. It purported to be written by a man with the unlikely name of Bathory Victor sometime in the 12th century. Mainly, it concerned itself with certain ghoulish and inhuman deities, and the ability of certain words to form metaphysical chains when spoken in the proper order and with the proper cadence. I'd never put any stock in this sort of superstitious nonsense before, but I remember how, after I loaned Kaylee the book, she would often ask me oblique questions regarding the interaction between ideas and reality, between thought and action, between consciousness and existence. She implied that words could act as a bridge, joining together the inner world of thought and the outer world of matter, a bridge that would allow the will to exert itself upon reality directly without the intermediary of the body. I laughed these off as harmless metaphysical ponderings. I wish I had paid more attention. Finally, the day I had been dreading arrived. Kaylee was well enough that Luthien demanded she return to his bed. I spent that night pacing the halls outside the couple's chamber door, and, anxious with a snifter of brandy clutched tight, I kept a close vigil, but as the hours dropped away, I heard nothing amiss. But during the bleak, small hours of night, the dark corridor lit only by a single, unsteady candle grasped tight in my hand, I thought I heard something from behind that door. I thought I heard something resembling a woman muttering. There was something behind it. A bass rumble. Like a distant earthquake or the sound of something impossibly heavy and immense, falling very, very far away. As I pressed my ear close, I could sense 12 distinct words, but could only make out 8 of them. There was some sort of prayer, or mad benediction, and the language they were in I could not place amongst all the tribes of man, but what I heard approximated this. I beseech Nothoth Yarmon, denizen of abyssal pylons. When the morning came, Kaylee was in high spirits. In stark contrast, Luthien spent the day in a most irritable mood, complaining at length about a powerful headache. Of course, I assumed he was merely hungover. The next night proved equally uneventful, and in the morning, when Luthien did not complain of a headache, I dared hope that the boy might have mended his ways. Curious, I sought out Kaylee. I found her, relaxing in the library with the Torzal Balthior open on her lap, and a platter of chocolates resting on a nearby table. When I inquired as to Luthien's sudden change of heart, she laughed and popped one of the chocolates into her mouth. "I have no idea what you are talking about," she said. "Luthien is the same as he ever was." At the breakfast table, Luthien looked wan and drawn. When I asked him if he were in any discomfort, he merely grunted a negative. From that day on, Luthien never remained out late, never raised his voice, became utterly docile and obedient toward his wife, although at times I observed him staring blankly into the distance, or letting drool carelessly leak from the corner of his mouth. Whatever dread I felt then was amorphous, thin and easily overwhelmed by my relief. Luthien died a few years later. He was 31. I found him sitting in his usual spot near the window, utterly still, and with his customary bland expression. The constabulary did not suspect foul play, but insisted upon an investigation for appearances. When Kaylee learned there was to be an autopsy, she pulled me aside and whispered harshly into my ear, "Those who exist to hunt my kind are rare in these times, but a few of Maedha's descendants are yet left, and I do not want any of them to find me out, and trust me, neither do you." I never confronted Kaylee about what I saw during the autopsy, and as I have stated already, 5 bribes and 1 bullet kept the doctors silent. Afterwards, I vacated my mansion as swiftly as I was able, leaving behind the requisite papers to turn it over into Kaylee's possession. I retired from business, and now I spend my days on the beaches of southern France, sipping overly sweet cocktails and gazing into the endless sparkling waters. But neither excessive sunlight nor excessive alcohol will ever remove the stains of what I saw from my mind. And inside Lucien's skull, where one would normally expect to find a healthy pink brain, I found instead an unwholesomely nourished mass of healthy flesh. One of the doctors nudged it with a scalpel, and dear God, it moved. It rolled over inside its bony abode to reveal that it was no shapeless lump of diseased flesh, but a living thing, resembling in every manner a naked human being, exaggerated to grotesque proportions from overnourishment. It wriggled and reached out to us with flappy little arms, and oh God, it spoke. It spoke to me. But before the writhing lips could utter more than 8 words, before I ran screaming from the autopsy ward, I snatched up the scalpel and I plunged it into that abomination's fetid heart. As I stumbled and tripped down the streets outside, I clutched my skull, begging God to drive the monstrous, hateful phrase uttered by that grotesque little thing from my mind. Yet the words remain with me to this day, nor shall they ever depart. For the burning letters of that incomplete phrase have been forever seared into my soul. I beseech Nothoth Yarmon, denizen of abyssal pylons.
Lovecraftiness, don't you just love to live in abject fear of the myriad abominations of nature that lie just beneath the thin and ethereal veil of reality? We do here at Cast Macabre. Yes, that's right. You're listening to Cast Macabre, not Pseudopod, just in case you had forgotten. Or are you?
I beseech Northoth Yaman, denizen of Abyssal Pylon.
Kill it! Feedback for episode 14. Kibitza says, I really thought the nice guy was going to end up being the psycho. Got that one wrong. Lovely blend of voices there, very well read and presented. Thanks, Kibitza. Kibitza also entered our discussion of how episode 13's Dracula's Guest may have been a chapter cut from the Dracula novel before it was published. He says, interesting, I can see where it would go, the beginning presumably, but it doesn't seem to fit. If the main character is Harker, this episode must have been completely wiped from his memory, because he still has trouble believing in the supernatural things he finds in Dracula's home. You'd think a strange undead lady, enormous lightning strikes, and a gigantic wolf sitting on your chest would go some way to enhancing one's credulity. Still, what do I know? Perhaps he suffered from that old Victorian literature standby. Brain fever. Good bit, sir. Don't we all? Don't we all?
Hi, I'm Norm Sherman, host of the Drabblecast, the weekly flash fiction podcast magazine that brings strange stories by strange authors to strange listeners. We do sci-fi, fantasy, horror. We do funny, strange, and gross. We bring you the best of the weird, the short stories that your favorite authors were too embarrassed to send to anyone else. I mean, where else are you going to hear things like this? Christ, Terry, what the hell is that thing?
I don't know, but it ain't no speckled perch, I can tell you that much.
Okt moved his eight legs aside. A body lay on the sea floor, and not even the drugs in Jell's system could make it look alive. We didn't say nothing about murder. It was a prank, a little kidnapping. Not dolphin aside. Emperor Mertzatz clenched his fists. His mighty voice bellowed throughout the stone corridors of his palace.
I'll get that panda!
The Drabblecast. Short, fun, different. Check us out at drabblecast.org.
Cast Macabre is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Music from Mevio at musicalley.com. Sound effects by the Free Sound Project. Links to songs and samples used in our show notes. This isn't a boilerplate outro, people. I rattle this stuff off fresh every time. If you like this story or the previous 14 and 3 stabs of fear, please consider donating at castmacabre.org. That's castmacabre.org. You can also visit our forums and leave some of your own feedback at forums.castmacabre.org. Next week we have another special treat for you, a Double Flash special. A narrator you may have heard of, and a story by Bram Stoker Award winner. Theme music by Paint Factor.